This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. How do modern couples find each other at bars, at parties, at church, online? Yes, and in another way as well, and we'll explore a method that is a throwback to an earlier time later in the program. First, the relationship between politics and corruption at the state level. A new study shows that the more removed a state capital is from the majority of its population, the more corrupt the government there is likely to be. And we explore that theory with the author of the study, Dr. Felipe Campante, Associate Professor of Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. He joins us by phone. Thank you for being with us this morning.
My pleasure.
And with us in our Spirit Square studios, Dr. Scott Huffman, Professor of Political Science and Founder and Director of the Social and Behavioral Research Laboratory at Winthrop University. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
And back again this week. He was here just last week. A man who has covered politics, the good and the bad, for many years for the Charlotte Observer, Jim Morrill. Good to see you as well.
Thanks, Mike.
So, Dr. Campante, your study uncovered the fact that the primary ingredient in the propensity for corruption in state government isn't politics. It isn't whether a government is controlled by the left or by the right. It is, of all things, geography. Now, I'm going to talk about that conclusion, but first let's talk about how you got there. Was the purpose of your study to look for reasons for corruption, or was there some other reason for the study?
Well, first of all, I'll be a little bit more modest in interpreting our results. I wouldn't go as far as saying that this factor that we focus on and that we uncover would be the primary explanatory factor behind corruption. But what we find is that it is an important one, even after you control for a number of factors that folks have typically found as being important when looking at corruption, such as political features of the political environment, levels of education, income, and so on. And actually, the way this research started was in trying to understand the impact of geography, really, on governance and political outcomes. I am originally from Brazil, and some of you may or may not know, but about 50 years ago, the capital of the country was moved to a very remote area of the country. And growing up there, I always had the sense that this had an impact on the level of isolation under which politicians operated. And then I decided to study that topic, and it occurred to me that U.S. states were likely a fertile ground because there's a lot of variation in terms of the degree of isolation of capital cities across U.S. states. And actually, we found that some people had already speculated about that link, and once we devised the tools to measure what we wanted to measure and started looking at the data, then the relationship popped out very robustly.
So you reached the conclusion that you came to by counting the number of federal corruption convictions in different states. But how did you make the leap from the number of convictions to the location of those states' capitals?
Yeah, so the measure of corruption, as you describe, is the main measure that we use. We use a few different ones. The main measure is the one that is standard in the literature that has studied corruption across U.S. states, which is the number of federal convictions for corruption-related crime. So that is the measure that we are trying to explain. And then we devise our own measure of the isolation of the capital city, which is essentially related to the average distance of the population in a given state from the capital city. So then we use some statistical techniques to try to tease out the effect of this measure of isolation on our measure of corruption, and we see that there is a positive and significant effect of our measure of isolation.
Well, given the measures that you used and the study that you did, what states have experienced the most corruption in their state governments?
Well, I think there is a difference between the levels of corruption, and I guess the states that are measured as having the highest levels of corruption may not be that surprising. So we see Louisiana or Mississippi, states that are known for a particularly corrupt political culture. But I think the states that one would think first when thinking about our story, namely the link between corruption and the isolation of the capital city, Those would be New York State or Illinois, Florida. These are states where the capital is very isolated. And frankly, if you look at other predictors that people have flagged for corruption, these states look a little bit more perplexing. So, you know, Chicago or rather Illinois New York State are relatively wealthy, relatively well-educated states. But once you consider this angle that we're trying to push, they start making a little bit more sense, the high levels of perceived corruption that exist in these places.
Dr. Huffman, did this surprise you, the results of this survey, or even the desire to take the survey? Did it surprise you?
No. Dr. Gabonte's, I think, results kind of go well with how we think about corruption in general. I mean, I think everybody who has had a child knows the philosophy, when the cat's away, the mice will play.
Yes.
And if you look at the measures that they have in this study, they're really good at basically saying how many eyes are on the government. If the general population, the concentration of population, is not there in the capital city, if they are somewhere else, then there are fewer journalists keeping an eye on government, what's going on. There are fewer voters to hear what's going on. There's just other stories that are taking up their time, so there are fewer eyes. That means that more money can come in and influence politics without as many people being as aware of it. And I think that's what we're seeing. And I think that if, the measure of people getting arrested is a very straightforward measure. But I think that this would continue to hold up if we used other measures. For example, I really like the state integrity investigations, the grades that they give, because it's not just on how many people are caught, but it's for the environment that allows corruption to fester. Because a lot of times, the politicians can get away with quite a lot. So lack of transparency, lack of strong ethics, things that contribute to a corrupt culture. If you look at the states that do poorly on those measures, they're the exact same states that Dr. Campante identified in this research. And while there are some very egregious states that even fall far off of his regression line in how corrupt they are, this holds true, and it is very much about how many eyes are on the government. The example that I've used, I actually was talking about this with a class earlier this week, is that water doesn't cause drowning. Lack of ability to swim causes drowning. You might not be able to swim, but you're not drowning right now because you're on dry land. Put you in water, and all of a sudden your lack of ability to swim is going to cause you to drown. So it's not the sheer physical distance that's causing the corruption. The sheer physical distance from the population allows these things to fester and grow and contribute to a corrupt culture.
This is a great argument for the Fourth Estate, Jim Morrill, particularly for newspapers, because television doesn't touch this kind of thing very often.
No, you're right. North Carolina is different than a lot of the states that the professor looked at. I mean, we don't have a dominant city in North Carolina like Chicago or New York.
Yes, we do, Jim.
Sure.
We're sitting in it.
I forgot that. Okay. But only in Charlotte would Raleigh be considered isolated.
Yes.
In North Carolina. But the fact is that there aren't as many eyes on state government as there used to be. I mean, just newspapers alone, Winston-Salem, Greensboro, Wilmington, Fayetteville, and Charlotte don't have anybody up there full time anymore like we used to. Now, the Charlotte Observer relies on our partners in Raleigh, the Raleigh News and Observer, for government coverage, but there's a general decline in the number of newspaper reporting eyes on the state government.
And the line, when you think about it, it goes Raleigh, Greensboro, High Point, Winston-Salem, Charlotte. That's a line from the north central part of the state down to the western part, the southwestern part of the state. What about people far east and far west? Anybody covering the state government in those areas? Because North Carolina is a wide state. It takes a long time to get from the west to the east by car.
Well, Asheville, when I started covering the legislature up there years ago, Asheville had a full-time reporter, Wilmington had a full-time reporter, and a lot of other papers did too. Now Asheville does not. Wilmington does not have a full-time person up there. And so there are a lot of areas that rely on AP coverage.
Well, let's talk about this distance, Dr. Campante, because you point out in your study that it is not clear whether a given distance means the same thing in states that are geographically small or large. You point out that 100 miles could be seen as a long distance in New Jersey, but not so much in California. So how did you determine the remoteness of a state capital?
Yes. Because of this factor that you're mentioning, we're actually a bit agnostic about the right way to adjust for the geographical size. So we actually look at different measures, some that do adjust, some that do not, and we actually show that the result is present for both of them. So it doesn't seem to be to matter that much, how much weight 100 miles have in a state rather than another. But I would like to point out, what my two fellow discussants have alluded to, because it was a very, very good description of what my research points out, which is exactly this mechanism of accountability and vigilance by the media, by voters, and so on. And that's, and we find very, very strong evidence that these things correlate strongly with the isolation of the capital city. And it's very interesting for me to listen to these to this perspective from the people who are in the trenches in terms of media coverage of state politics and so on, to see that it kind of rings a bell, and that actually this mechanism might be getting even stronger, in the sense that coverage, as we all know, newspapers are undergoing a major transition, and it seems like political coverage at the state level is one of the first things on the chopping block, exactly, and more so when you have these relatively isolated capital cities.
But even as newspapers are going through transition, they're going through transition, as many media are, because of the digital age and what digital technology is bringing to us. But the digital age seems to also be on the same path with the death of distance, because we get information now from various sources instantaneously. How can politicians hide, no matter how remote their capital is, given Twitter and Facebook and social media, where people find out about something in the state capital and start tweeting it out to their friends, who tweet it out to other people, who tweet it out to newspaper reporters, etc.?
A lot of those people who do that come from an interest group or an ideological bent. You know, there's a lot of Twittering that goes on in Raleigh and I'm sure Columbia. And a lot of it is by there's been a proliferation of groups that have, like I said, an ideology point of view, progressive or conservative, that do this. So people are getting a kind of a one-sided opinion.
But what I guess the point I'm trying to make here is that in horse and buggy days, even car days, early automobile days, when your state capital's in Tallahassee, for instance, and you're living in Miami, that's a pretty long distance, and Tallahassee is not as big probably as Miami is.
Right, but you know what you're thinking of is somebody in Miami can easily get the news from Tallahassee. My argument would be the people on Twitter in Miami probably not following news sources out of Tallahassee. Think of the way people follow on Twitter, and I don't mean people that consume the news like, you know, the listeners of WFAE. I mean, you know, people who aren't nearly as informed. If they have any news sources at all, they're going to be local. They're probably not going to be from the Capitol, and then they're going to be some national stuff. So they're more likely to hear about twerking at video awards than they are about corruption in their state capital 200 miles away, even on Twitter.
We're talking about a study that Dr. Felipe Campante, one of our guests, conducted that determined that one of the principal factors in indicating how much corruption might go on in a state government is the location of the capital with regard to the center of its population. He's with the Harvard University Kennedy School. Dr. Scott Huffman is with us from Winthrop University, and Jim Morrill, a longtime political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits, presenting the 2013 Statewide Conference for Staff and Board Leaders of North Carolina Nonprofits, September 19th and 20th in Concord, ncprofits.org, and the U.S. National Whitewater Center Labor Day Celebration, Sunday 5K and 15K trail races, live music from the Dirt Governors, and the fireworks display, usnwc.org. Tomorrow marks the 50th anniversary of a watershed event in American history. It could be argued that the historic March on Washington in 1963 was the pinnacle of the tumultuous civil rights movement, the moment when America changed, as Dr. King described his dream. We visit with an activist who was there, a journalist who covered it, and someone organizing the commemorative celebration tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, thousands of firefighters are struggling to control a giant wildfire threatening Yosemite National Park and San Francisco's water supply, battling wildfires in the West.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Philippe Campante is an associate professor of public policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School. He and others conducted a study that determined that the location of a state capital with regard to its center of population could be used as a yardstick to measure the propensity for corruption. And also with us is Dr. Scott Huffman, political science professor at Winthrop University, founder and director of the Social and Behavioral Research Lab down there, and Jim Morrill, a political reporter for the Charlotte Observer. State capitals have been in their various locations. I mean, a few have moved over time, but they've pretty much been where they are for the last several hundred years. Why were some located closer to population centers than others? And I'm not sure who of you to ask this question of.
Well, Dr. Campante, please go ahead.
Yeah, because I've looked a little bit into this history, and actually, they changed a lot for a while. So during the 18th, 19th century, there's been quite a bit of change in the number of states, but they have been very stable for a long while. I think the last one that moved was in Oklahoma, and that was like 1910. So for a century, there hasn't been any move in capital cities. But if you look at the history, it's quite intriguing because the people who are discussing this, and not only in the context of states, but also in the context of the federal capital, in the first Congress, when the federal capital was being chosen, there was a clear sense that there was an impact of the location of the capital on representation, on governance in general, and actually a reason that you see cited quite often for locating the capital city in a relatively isolated place was precisely to protect state government from undue influence of big economic interests. So one idea that was very current in those discussions was that if the capital were to be located very close to the major centers of economic activity, that would be a very high risk of capture of state politics by those big political interests. And so one reason was precisely to protect, to isolate state governments from that influence. But
Did that ever work? Because your study shows that today it's not working. In fact, the farther away that a state capital is from the center of its population or even its financial centers, the more money is used in influencing legislators. So did it ever work?
Exactly. So we can't really say, we don't have the historical data to figure out whether it has ever worked, but it clearly seems that in a contemporary setting, it's backfired pretty much.
Now, North and South Carolina have both moved their capitals in the history of the states. The one in South Carolina, Columbia, smack dab in the middle of the state. Was it moved, Scott? Was it moved to the Midlands of South Carolina because it would be in the middle of the state, or was it moved to get away from Charleston, which was the economic engine of the state?
Well, a little of both, and I believe if I remember, I haven't read it in a bit, but it's Dr. Campante actually, I believe, quotes James Madison when he talks about we need to move this from a population center, it needs to be center, the federal capital, and so. In South Carolina, there's actually a rule for every county seat that it needs to be central so that everybody has equidistance to travel to get to their county seat. And so you have counties like York County, which is, York is the county seat, but it's actually very small compared to the much larger, Rock Hill, the city of, almost 70,000 versus a small little town. And the idea that it should be the capital whether it's the county seat or the state capital, should be central so everybody has equal access, was both this Democratic, small d, Democratic idea that everybody ought to be able to get to it and have access, but also to remove it from the interest. But remember, just because our founders thought this is the way it's going to work, as Dr. Componte pointed out, it backfired. Our founders also didn't believe in political parties. You know, George Washington's final words were, "Let me warn you in the most solemn manner about the baneful effects of the spirit of party." And yet they designed a system that could only, according to Duvarger's law, could only create a two-party system. So they thought they were setting up a system of protections from parties, and it backfired, and we have parties. They thought they were setting up a system that protected from undue influence, and in the end, it might have contributed to it, as Dr. Componte points out.
But the very location of Columbia seems to be, it's centralized. So I would think that would not be characterized as a remote capital, would it?
It's not the physical distance, although the physical distance clearly plays into the model that we see. It's the distance from the population centers. The population, the biggest chunks of population, are not in Columbia. Columbia is a big city, but the population is going to be much heavier in the Greenville-Spartanburg and in the Charleston area. So you have these huge population densities that believe the world revolves around them each, that are paying a little less attention to the happenings in the state house than the population in Columbia.
What about North Carolina?
Well, I think North Carolina is different. I think the population is more spread out, but I think that Raleigh is definitely a population center. I think there's almost 2 million people in the Triangle, which is as big as the Charlotte area. And so those are the two main population centers in North Carolina, so I don't think it's quite the same as South Carolina.
Let's go back to James Madison. You point out, Dr. Componte, in your study that James Madison urged that the U.S. Capitol be located in that spot which will be least removed from every part of the empire. Those are his words. Washington, D.C., arguably, I guess, is the halfway point between New England and the Deep South, but now the country has spread to the West, and so there are whole vast stretches of the country that are deeply removed from the nation's capital. Has Washington suffered from corruption as a result of that?
Well, you could argue that this has an impact, although, you know, I think the forces might be a little different. I actually have some of my other research dealing with these issues at the country level. So, and it's definitely true that Washington is a pretty isolated capital when you compare it against other countries. But I wanted to point out, I think it was a very interesting discussion that we engage with very much in our research, which is this point about state capitals and, you know, the national capital being located in relatively central positions, and that having to do with a desire not necessarily for insulation, but rather to facilitate representation, the idea that everyone should be as close as possible to the capital city, so the capital city shouldn't give privileges to one region rather than another. And this is actually something that we use in our work to try to figure out whether there is actually a causal impact, whether isolated capitals cause more corruption. So we actually use this type of this feature of the designation of capital cities. And the answer is that, yes, there seems to be a causal impact. But, you know, it's very interesting that there was this recognition that the location of the capital city mattered for representation and for governance and for a number of important features of the political system.
Your study also points out that when most of a newspaper's audience is very far from the capital, that newspaper will devote fewer resources and less space for covering state-level politics. In this digital age, we're also noticing that people are creating their own newspapers. They choose what stories they are interested in, and those come to them in feeds. And so they're ignoring vast stretches of things that they don't think they're interested in, and that would probably include, if you live far away from a state capital, state politics and state government. Are we exacerbating this problem? Are we artificially making state capitals even more remote than they actually are?
Well, I think that's an excellent point, and it speaks to that issue of the death of distance that we were discussing earlier, because I think a lot of what's driving this impact on the level of coverage is what we economists would call the demand side of the story. So the fact is that people who are far from the capital seem to demand less, be less interested in what's going on there. And because of that, you know, the fact that now you could get instantaneous information on what's going on in the capital city doesn't mean that you will actually do that. And I think it may well be the case that the factors that are bringing about the death of distance are quite paradoxically perhaps aggravating this feature precisely because of what you mentioned. Now people may be more, maybe better able to tailor their news to their own interests, and maybe state politics will fall to the wayside even harder, particularly in those states where the capital is in this isolated location.
And the media is guilty of tailoring their coverage to drive ratings, to drive, I would think, subscription sales, or to drive paper sales at the newsstand, or website views. I'm putting words in your mouth, Jim Morrill. So from the observer's point of view, obviously you know what stories people are reading online because you can track that information. It seems to me that magazines for years have studied what kind of a cover sells the magazine. Do you tailor your coverage to what your readers want?
Sure, to a large extent. I mean, we try to give people what they want. And, you know,
is that good?
I don't think it's a secret to say that for years, legislative news has been kind of a hard sell in Charlotte. In Raleigh, it's a local story and it gets a lot of coverage, and Columbia does the same. In Charlotte, it's always been kind of a hard sell. This year has been different. What's happened in Raleigh this year has been so dramatic and so pivotal in
changing loss. And did that happen because people weren't paying attention? They didn't know who they were electing? They didn't know what the agenda was going to be when they got there?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I would say that there are so many things that happened. You know, this legislature was so busy, as you'll talk about tomorrow night at the Observer Forum, that they made a lot of substantive changes.
Yes, and they'll say, and they're right, I think, that they were elected to do those things. That's why they are there. That's why the turnover from Democrat to Republican in the legislature and of the governor's mansion. But there are a lot of people who are upset by saying, this is not what we voted for. Well, it is, isn't it? Did you know what you were voting for? That's the question.
I think a lot of people would say that they went further than they thought. You know, people voted for individual legislators and probably weren't aware of all that they were going to get.
You want to chime in on this, Scott Huff?
No, I've got an hour-long program on how gerrymandering at the local level contributed to all this, and I don't think you have time for that.
Okay.
I do want to come back to Dr. Combante's point about the paradox of how access to information everywhere has actually siloed information. And again, it has. If you can personalize the news you get, I no longer get my paper subscription. I now get all my news online, and I find I don't read all the stories. I'm sorry, Jim. So I saw brow crease when I said that. I no longer read all the stories that I used to, because if I opened the paper and it was on the page, I was going to consume every bit of it. I got a much broader set of the news. Now I focus on the news I'm interested in. Frankly, I only crack sports pages now during college basketball season, whereas I used to see it all. And the same is, I think, true for most people about political stories.
The location of state capitals in relation to the population isn't just a predictor of corruption. It may also be a predictor of competence. Dr. Campante, did you find that in states with isolated capitals that they suffer from mismanagement as well? And if so, why would that be?
Well, what we find is that when we look at the output that the government delivers that we are all worried about, you know, the provision of public goods, of education, of healthcare, welfare, and so on, we do find a similar link whereby states with isolated capital cities seem to perform worse in terms of, you know, educational outcomes, provision of healthcare, and so on. And that seems to fit a story in which the lower levels of accountability feed into higher levels of corruption, and that leads to poorer outputs, poorer performance in terms of government. Now, we can't pinpoint the connections there, but it seems to make sense to the extent that governments that are less accountable, that are perhaps more corrupt, you would expect that this might have an influence on, you know, their ultimate performance. And we find what we find is consistent with that idea, with that story.
But what is there a role that competence plays in this? It would seem to me that it would be difficult. It would be much easier to lure a competent person into a governing a state department, for instance, Department of Education in a state, or the Department of Highways in a state, if the capital city in which he had to live and work offered a lot of stuff to do, like Boston versus Tallahassee versus Pierre, is it North or South Dakota? I don't even know what the capital is. It would seem to me to lure somebody there who has a high pedigree of talent, you'd want to be able to offer them something.
Yes. So, there could be something going in that direction. What we do find, interestingly enough, is kind of a small piece of evidence, but we do find that politicians seem to be better rewarded in those states with isolated capitals. And, you know, this could be, you know, politicians being able to line up their pockets also through legal means besides, you know, the illegal sort of corrupt means. But it could also be that it takes more money to lure people to go to one of these isolated capitals. But interestingly enough, we find that this effect is prevalent even when we control for real estate prices, which can indicate the level of desirability. So even, mm-hmm. you know, controlling for how expensive it is to live in the capital rather than, you know, some other place, it seems that politicians are able to get more money in states with isolated capital cities. But we cannot discard that some of that effect might go through this sort of competence channel that you're pointing at. Maybe, you know, part of the reason is that it's harder to get higher quality bureaucrats or politicians to go to, you know, a less desirable location.
Mike, remember as well that not all state cap or not all states have a full-time legislature. You have everything from temporary once every 2 years to part-time every year.
Right.
So that's a controlling factor.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. That's why we only look at actually governor salaries, precisely because it's very hard to compare the salaries of legislatures because their workings are so different.
Did I hear you say that in these states with remote capitals that they tend to spend less on education, welfare, and other social programs? Did I hear you correctly?
Yes, that's what we find.
Why would that be? Is that because they are of a particular political persuasion, or because they simply don't see the need for this because they're so far removed from urban centers?
I would say it seems that it's because of this isolation. So it's not really like a partisan or an ideological issue. I think it's more about being less responsive to what the electorate wants.
So we went through all of this in North Carolina this year. Is that because Raleigh is remote? Or is it strictly partisan?
I think in this case, it's partisan and ideological. I don't think it's because Raleigh is remote.
Do you want to comment on that?
I would just point out that Raleigh didn't become all that more or less remote, you know, from the last legislature to this one. So there's probably some other factors that are going on to explain this change.
Dr. Philip Campanti, Associate Professor of Public Policy at the Harvard University Kennedy School, Dr. Scott Hoffman, Political Scientist at the Winthrop University, and Jim Morrill, a political reporter with the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all for this and a very interesting study, Doctor. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
It was my great pleasure.
We're going to take a break. Come right back with more Charlotte Talks in a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fisher & Phillips, LLP, a national labor and employment law firm representing employers in North Carolina from the Charlotte and Columbia offices. Partner Kevin Dalton and Fisher & Phillips on the web at laborlawyers.com. And Group Benefit Solutions, providing clarity to Carolina companies uncertain about health care reform. Details available at gbs-benefits.com. Thousands of firefighters are struggling to control a giant wildfire threatening Yosemite National Park and San Francisco's water supply. They'll be talking about that today in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. And tomorrow night, we are joining up with the Charlotte Observer and WTVI for a public forum with Mecklenburg delegates to the North Carolina General Assembly. That forum is at CPCC's Pease Auditorium. It's sold out, but you can hear the results of that Friday morning here at 9. We're coming back and talking about matchmaking in just a moment.
What would $950 pay for? I really prefer to think of our card paying for Click and Clack's coffee machine or their dental care or something. You know?
Perhaps the fabric in the seatbelts can be recycled into NPR tote bags.
I'm Lauren Brown.
And her husband, Lenny Hort.
And we donated our 1995 Toyota Camry station wagon to public radio.
Find out how you can help at WFAE.org. And thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It is true that in the 21st century, an enormous number of couples still meet each other in traditional ways and places. It's also true that a rapidly growing number find each other at online dating sites. But there is one method that has been going on for centuries and one that continues to this day. Some couples meet through a matchmaker. In Jewish culture, matchmakers are also referred to as a yenta.
Yenta, yenta. Well, somebody has to arrange the matches.
Well, she might bring someone wonderful.
Someone interesting.
And well off.
And important.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a match. Find me a find, catch me a catch. Night after night in the dark I'm alone. So find me a match of my life.
And we're going to meet our own Yenta, our own matchmaker. She is Laurie Berzak of High Expectations, which caters exclusively to the Jewish community. She also has a non-Jewish branch of her, I hate to say business, but it's a business. She sees this as following her life's passion and filling a void in her hometown. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Nice to see you again. And also with us are a couple who met through Laurie's service. Ken Markovitz and Sarah Bryan are getting married in October. Congratulations.
Actually, November.
Oh, you moved it, did you?
No.
Okay.
No.
I was misinformed.
My bad. No, November 10th.
Okay, more chance for our listeners to buy you a gift.
Exactly. That's great.
So how is being a matchmaker, Laurie, one of your life's passions? How did this start for you? How did you learn to become one?
Wow, that's a really great question. And I should tell you that the non-Jewish branch of my matchmaking business launched last September. It's called Carolina's Matchmaker. Mm-hmm. I've always been a connector of people, whether it be for friendships or jobs. And then about 8.5 years ago or so, I introduced a couple here in Charlotte. They ended up falling madly in love and moving in together. And it made my heart sing. It made me really, really happy that I created happiness for another couple.
Doing it once could be serendipity.
Yes.
Doing it repeatedly.
Yes.
Requires, I think, some kind of a talent or second sense or something. I don't know. You've been relatively successful.
I have been. Four out of five of the people that hire me find love either directly through one of my matches, mm-hmm. or on their own within a year or two, which I attribute a lot to my coaching.
If I understand this, yenta in Yiddish means busybody.
Busybody, exactly.
And that's what a matchmaker is, somebody who is involved in all these social networking connections, who knows intuitively that this person belongs with that person, and they get involved and push them together, right?
Yes, and I'm very intuitive for my entire life. People have always told me things, personal things about themselves, and I use that information in my matchmaking, obviously, to really get to the core of people's character, mm-hmm. and find out exactly what they're looking for in someone, which assists me in the matching process.
And this has been going on in the Jewish community for years, and not just the Jewish community. This happens in Japan. It mm-hmm. happens in other cultures all over the world.
It does.
But in this situation with Ken and Sarah, this busybody didn't just come into your life and push you together. You kind of came to her in both cases, right, Ken?
Yes. She was introduced to me by a friend of mine up in Asheville, and I came down and I interviewed with her for 3 to 4 hours and just literally sat there and told her everything about me, my family, who I am, where I come from, what I'm looking for. And a couple weeks later, she called me and said, I think I found someone. You're going to meet Sarah.
Was that the interview an awkward interview, or was it something that you enjoyed doing?
Well, it could have been awkward if you think about it, but Laurie was so open and welcoming, and she was so kind, and she had a lot of good questions that I didn't even have the answers for right there on the spot. I
think what?
Well, for example, what exactly are you looking for in a woman? And I had never met anybody like Sarah, and I said, you know, here's a list of what in my mind is going to be the perfect woman for me. And at the end of the interview, I think the last thing I said to her is I said, here's the thing, Lori, I have never met anybody like this. So you could introduce me to somebody exactly like this, and I may hate that person. So you're going to have to figure out from what you know of me and what I've described of me, is this actually going to be the person I'm really looking
for?
So
what do you think he wanted? What did you decide he wanted?
Well, Ken is an extreme extrovert. He owns a successful DJing company, and I knew that the type of woman that he was meeting at the local clubs was not, you know, that were getting drunk and were throwing themselves, you know, at him and at all the staff people because they were really out of it, were not the right kind of people. He wasn't meeting the right kind of people. He wasn't meeting quality people. And he wanted to meet someone who was Jewish. And I wanted to find someone for him that was super smart and fun. And also, I thought extroverted would be good for Ken. And Sarah had applied with me, and she can tell her story.
So you already knew Sarah?
I did, okay, from years before.
What was your experience coming to Lori?
Well, I was first working in the Jewish community at Temple Beth El, and I grew up in Charlotte. I know the Jewish community very well. And if I were to meet somebody, I would have already met them. So when I first met Lori, she said, hey, meet with me. You can get in my database. Maybe if I have a good client that you'd be a great match for, you never know. So I interviewed with her like 3.5 years prior to meeting Ken. And so when I received the phone call from her, it was really out of the blue. And she just said, just because I haven't talked to you doesn't mean I haven't been thinking about you. And then the rest is history. She said, I think you'd make a great match for one of my clients.
So you didn't know what you wanted. Did you know what you wanted, Sarah?
Yes.
What did you want?
I wanted somebody tall. And but beyond
how tall
that,
are you, Ken?
6'3".
Okay. Oh my. Okay.
But more than that, I wanted someone who would make me laugh, who was very intelligent and would keep me on my toes, but also as a hard worker and most importantly, a kind soul.
You said you didn't know what you wanted exactly. What did you get?
Well, I got Sarah. I got more than I bargained for. That's for sure. she is definitely fantastic. I definitely said one thing specific. I did not want a wallflower because my personality is so strong and I am such a big personality as well as a big guy that I would literally run a wallflower over and I needed my match.
And you said you wanted a big guy. You wanted somebody physically imposing.
I can handle that. Yes.
In this age of Match.com and other dating services like that, and you know, speed dating at lunch and things like that, what do matchmakers bring to the process that a computer program cannot?
Experience with learning people's character and understanding the dating process. I do a lot of coaching. Sometimes people mess up. Just little things like not walking a woman to her car at the end of a date is a total deal breaker. Different things along those lines. I think that what a matchmaker brings is someone who asks the right questions, hears what the person is looking for, and then determines what would be a good match for that person. So just because someone tells me what they're looking for doesn't necessarily mean they know everything. So sometimes I can sort of intuit from a different angle.
The two of you reacted to something she just said. What was that reaction?
Oh, I thought that actually she walked me to my car.
Okay.
And then she corrected me and said, no, I actually walked her because I couldn't remember whose car it was that we got to.
You know, it seems to me that, Lori, if you are, as a matchmaker, good at what you do, you don't get much repeat business. And if you're not good at what you do, then I doubt you get much repeat business. So how do you build a business based on putting people together for the rest of their lives?
I know. That's a really good point. I have had renewals, by the way. People who have been very happy with my services, you get a certain amount of introductions for a certain period of time. Word of mouth, referrals, people find out about me and tell their friends. Sarah, you know, and Ken have told folks about me. I have, thank God, a good reputation in the community. I work all over the Carolinas and Georgia as well with high expectations.
Now, high expectations, and that's C-H-A-I,
yes.
And that's, is that also Yiddish? Chai?
It means life in Hebrew.
Okay. L'chaim?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So High Expectations is focused on the Jewish community, and Carolina's Matchmaker is focused on the Gentile community. There is a tradition in Judaism of this matchmaker situation, not so much in the non-Jewish community. So what kind of reaction have you gotten among the non-Jewish community?
It's been fabulous. People are really open. The problem is, even here in Charlotte, there's so few ways to meet people besides going to the bars, getting set up with friends. And normally, the people that come to me are folks who all their friends are married and they're starting to have kids. And they're challenged with they have outrun their networks, and basically I have a much larger network, and that's what they're buying into. So they're hiring me as a recruiter and as a coach and as somebody who really cares about them. So I only take on a certain amount of clients every year. It's expensive because I can't work with everybody. Mm-hmm. Then I have a large database of free members. And that's what Sarah was
do
in,
people
for example.
Come, do, you said that they've outrun their network
yes.
of friends. So they've run out of people to meet,
yes.
Essentially. And they don't like the people that they're meeting in places like bars and people like that, because it's just the wrong environment
right.
and you're getting the wrong group. So have they tried most of these people? Have they tried everything else? Have they tried Match.com? Have they tried the speed dating things? Have they gone to their churches, their synagogues, their temples, and tried to meet people?
Yes.
Just nothing?
Yes. Sometimes they don't try online mm-hmm. because they have an important position in the community and they just don't want their faces out there. So I get a lot of folks like that.
What about the two of you? What did you try before this?
Well, in Asheville, where I was living before, there was not a very large single Jewish female population of 25 to 35 educated people. Mm-hmm. There's just not a lot of single women in Asheville. So for me, it was very difficult. Not that there's any, and I want to make a disclaimer. There's nothing wrong with people that go to bars. I'm not saying that. What I wanted for myself, that
a
was
lot
a separation.
Of people meet at your parties.
A lot of people meet. I've DJed a lot of weddings for people that have met at my shows.
Uh-huh.
So I'm perfectly, there is a market for that there. But for me, because I own my own company and because I'm doing that for a living, I wanted a separation.
Right.
I didn't want to have the person that was coming to my shows and then them coming to my shows while I'm working. I wanted to go home to something separate.
Both of you wanted Jewish individuals.
Yes. Yes.
And you say, Laurie, that faith plays a big role in this, whether you're Christian mm-hmm. or Muslim or, mm-hmm. or Jewish. Mm-hmm. Is that because if you're from the same faith background, that you will – the likelihood of the relationship taking permanently is higher?
I think so. I think that it really helps – if you come from the same place culturally, it's just one less thing that you need to figure out. I mean, obviously, I know plenty of folks that have married out of the faith or out of their culture that they grew up in, but marriage is difficult, mm-hmm. as we know. Folks that have been married, I've married 19 years now, and it's one less thing to have to worry about or have to maneuver through life in terms of raising kids and whatnot. So it's one of the major things that I discuss when I sit with someone is how do they want to raise their family in the future.
And
how do they pray?
And you say
they do.
That when you put people together for that first date, you're looking 10, 20, 50 years mm-hmm. down the road.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that based on people you've had a short interview with in the scheme of things? I know it's a long interview process, but it's short in the scheme of things. How do you do that?
I really try to look at core values, and I try to dig into what drives people? What are they most passionate about? What are some things about themselves that they don't like?
Mm-hmm.
What's sort of the yin and the yang of a real connection? And how I really want to find somebody, their soulmate, so that will complete them.
Were you confident when you introduced Ken and Sarah?
I thought it would be a great match.
Why?
I was super excited
Why?
About it. Part of it is just a real gut instinctive feeling. They're both real positive people, both very active in the communities. And I remember specifically Ken saying, I want mm-hmm. someone that has a light behind her eyes and a beautiful smile. And I mean, look at Sarah. You can really see that.
What were the non-negotiables for you, Sarah? You absolutely had to have this in somebody.
I absolutely had to have someone with a kind heart. And that's a really great question. Kind heart, thinks about others before themselves, and that family was really important, creating a family.
Ken?
Yes.
Pretty much the same, yeah. I figured that with somebody that's going to put up with me, because I am not easy to put up with. Sarah does a great job of that. She was teaching sixth grade. She's now teaching eighth grade, and she has now compared me to the sixth graders more so than the eighth graders. I'm like a big kid. She's like, I deal with them all day long. I can handle you.
Now, I was going to ask you what the first date was like, but then I read a comment that you made, Ken, about the first date, and you said that after 20 minutes, you knew, you both knew,
That's true. It was right.
We were finishing each other's sentences within 20 minutes on our first date.
Absolutely. I have never met a man that would leave me speechless. As much as he's a talker, I'm a language arts.
Left you speechless because he was finishing your sentence.
I know. That's true. But it's very hard to get me off guard and not want to talk. And all I wanted, it was like that gut feeling where it was like, oh my gosh, this is somebody completely different. But I felt like I had known him forever.
Yeah, after 20 minutes, that's exactly how it felt like. And one of the really cool things was on our first date, before we went out, Lori said, in case you get to a point where you don't know what to say, you both need to know the answer to this question. What are the top 5 items on your bucket list? So 3.5 hours into the first date, we hadn't stopped talking. Sarah's like, did you do your homework? And I said, what?
So I have about a minute left. What is your success rate?
So I do say 4 out of 5 of the people that hire me are successful. And a lot of that is due to the coaching that I do, like giving people advice on how do you handle yourself on a first date? How do you conduct yourself after the date? Do you text? Do you call? Do you dispose of all the games that people tell you to do, the rules and whatnot, when you know it's the real deal, and that type of thing? And one of my couples is having babies soon.
Wow.
And that's what I determine as success.
Of course, you're both from the Jewish community, so there's a tradition of this. But do people, friends, non-Jewish friends, look at you like you went to a matchmaker? You did what?
I think my friends were not surprised at all, considering who I am. But I think they're always amused and interested.
Sarah Bryan is a teacher. Ken Markovitz is a disc jockey, owner of Eclipse Entertainment. They're both getting married in November. Laurie Burzak is the matchmaker from High Expectations that put them together. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.